Hello, and welcome back to Elder Sign, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brandon Buddha. In today's episode, we'll be talking about Seabury Quinn's 1926 story, The House of Horror.
This is another installment in our series on occult detectives. This is a series that our Patreon supporters decided we should do this year on Elder Sign, and I want to say a huge thanks to those supporters for voting on this. And speaking of thanks, we also want to thank our sponsor for this episode. This is writer John R. Foltz. Foltz's new collection, Darker Than Weird, is out now, and it is an awesome collection. We think that you'll really enjoy it. It's got 14 stories in it, which is a lot. That's actually a pretty big collection, but I want to draw your attention to one in particular on this episode. This is the story Anno Domini Azathoth. Obviously, the title of the story is invoking Lovecraft, and that's a big draw for me. But Foltz really here, I think, takes a page out of Robert E. Howard's book in that this is a mythos story that is set in the American Southwest. It's also set in the 18th century. It's told from the point of view of a Franciscan missionary. So, I don't know, it felt like it was basically tailor-made for me. I was delighted to have a chance to read it, and I think that you, dear listener, will as well. But Brandon, what grabbed you from the collection?
Well, I couldn't resist a story with a title like The Lord of Endings. This is another story from the section of Foltz's book that is covering some Lovecraftian mythos elements. I loved this story. This borrows a lot from Lovecraft's dream stories. This is also a tale of like imperialism and invasion and imperialistic resistance. This story offers a Lovecraftian solution to an imperial invasion or occupation in territory. I don't want to give too much more away because it would give away kind of the shock and discomfort that's in the root of this story. But this is a challenging story, I think, conceptually. It's lucidly told, though, and clearly communicated. I love the dream world that Foltz has come up with. I would describe it maybe the language and concepts as like Lovecraft by way of Jack Vance or maybe Clark Ashton Smith. It's just, it's great. So this is one I recommend. There's a lot of discomfort though that Foltz is prodding here. So really, again, once again, just recommend this story wholeheartedly. This collection's been a really great discovery for us, I think. And it's been really awesome for us to have encountered these stories.
I think it's fair to say that Lovecraft has been an influential dude on a lot of writers and on the category of weird fiction. But I think his Dreamland stories have been less influential than they deserve to be. And in fact, you and I have not even really covered any Dreamland stories here on the show, you know, and we're like 5 years into this at this point. So maybe that's something that we can correct soon ourselves. But at any rate, we hope that you all will check out Darker Than Weird by John R. Foltz. I've put some links in the show notes to make that really easy for you here. But let's get into it. Let's turn our attention to The House of Horror by Seabury Quinn.
Yeah, this story is amazing. It is probably one of the most foundational horror stories we've read on this network. I mean, I can't imagine a story that does more with its concept in terms of building a foundation for what horror is today. All of that we'll look a little bit at in our discussion. But before we get there, Glenn, what's going on in this story?
Yeah, right. This story is the sixth story from Seabury Quinn that features his occult detective, Jules de Grandon. And these are, you know, mystery stories, supernatural mystery stories. We have covered the very first story here on Elder Sign before. That was The Horror on the Lynx. And then coming up, we're actually going to cover the second story, which is The Tenants of Broussac. So here, at least, we are doing things out of order, but I will say that these aren't really the type of stories where that matters very much, but this story does expect that you at least come to it knowing that Jules de Grandon is an occult detective, knowing that he's from France, and also knowing that he is basically the Sherlock to Samuel Trowbridge's Watson. Though in this case, they are both medical doctors. That's actually kind of an interesting idea here in these stories that I think we talked about before when we did Horror on the Lynx. And well, if we didn't, we're going to talk about it eventually because it turns out we're doing a handful of these stories. And I'm very excited about that. And the deal is that de Grandon and Trowbridge live together in Trowbridge's house in New Jersey. This adventure opens in medias res with Trowbridge just driving around New Jersey so that they can get to a patient. And this is not an occult case. It's diphtheria. The patient is a child of a laborer who is working on building a new railroad line in the area. None of that is actually going to matter, though, because it's really all just a setup for Trowbridge to get lost. And it's also raining, we should say, which here in the 1920s is a much bigger deal when you're driving at night than it is for us now, a century later. At any rate, because of this, because they're lost, because it's raining, they give up trying to save this child. And at one point, they really just shrug their shoulders and say, well, at this point, she's probably already dead anyway, which I will say did not sit well with me and is perhaps the first of several missteps in this story, at least from my perspective. I think that's something we'll maybe butt heads about a little bit in the discussion. But the point is that although they are lost, they do find a house in the middle of nowhere with a light on. And Trowbridge at this point, he's kind of disturbed by this discovery because he thinks that he knows every house around here. So where did this house come from and who lives here? But de Grandin is not having it. And so they park the car, they dash through the rain. And when they get to the front door, it unlocks and opens all on its own. And then when they cross the threshold, the door shuts and locks again, all on its own. It's very spooky. It's an amazing hook.
It's so good. Yeah, I had to look up C. Barry Quinn's credits on IMDb, of which he has basically none. And the reason why I wanted to look up C. Barry Quinn is because this story, I guess, basically invents Vincent Price movies and like Hammer horror movies. You know, I don't have enough of a sense of the history of the kind of story that we're about to get here. But so much of what Quinn does, not just in the opening of this story, but throughout the story, just feels foundational to me in what is essentially something like a funhouse horror story. And I'll tell you now, when handled well, or when it shows up in a horror story, the funhouse is one of my favorite horror tropes and settings.
We had talked previously when we've done C. Barry Quinn, when we did the first story, we talked about how he clearly was a massive and really just foundational influence on a lot of the TV that you and I love. I mean, specifically, we were invoking Angel there, but really any occult detective who's been on TV owes its origin to Jules de Grandin, to these C. Barry Quinn stories. But I think that you're right here as well to be thinking about this. I mean, we're getting ahead of ourselves maybe a little bit of also having some influence on horror film, other aspects of supernatural or speculative fiction. I think C. Barry Quinn is underrated and unsung as really the inventor of so much of our pop culture, which, you know, I think we were well aware of that when we did Horror on the Links, but it's just becoming clearer and clearer as we read these stories. And it's a real shame that I didn't know who this person was until I was middle-aged.
Well, I think one of the reasons that he's unsung, and I think we're going to be talking about this a lot, is that while Quinn is maybe laying the foundation for much of what might be considered, you know, classic 20th century horror, he hasn't met a cliche he doesn't love. So, yeah, we get this mechanical door that brings us into the plot of the story. That's fantastic. You know, Trowbridge mentioning that the mansion shouldn't be there is also really great, and it works well in the story. But the introduction to this story, the opening of the story is basically full of it was a dark and stormy night sort of business. And then we have two friends lost on the back roads in the middle of this torrential storm. And then we have these real problems that you've already pointed out, too. We have the, you know, oh, well, a child might have died because we're lost. That bit doesn't really give us any sympathy towards Trowbridge and de Grandin, our heroes, especially when we get to the end of the story. And then, of course, Jules is so over the top, capital F French. It's absurd. So I wouldn't actually blame anyone for bouncing off of the opening of the story or Quinn in general, but I'd really encourage them to read on because I'm on Team C. Barry Quinn here, even though he needs to write another draft of this whole story, at least to get it to where we want him to be. So yeah, it's a great opening, but it's riddled with cliche.
It is. I'll just say up front too, even though I think as we've said, we're getting way ahead of ourselves here. I also am on Team Seabury Quinn. This is only the second one of these stories that we've covered on the show, but I loved the first one so much that I read about half of the volume that we have these stories in, and I have loved every single one of them up until this one. This is the one that I haven't loved, but I'm definitely on Team Seabury Quinn here as well. So I'll say that up front for when I start to get a little grumpy about this as we get deeper into the story. And, you know, this opening, it was an unsettling opening here, an unsettling welcome to this house, this mansion. But even while that's unsettling, it's not an abandoned place. It's not even a haunted place. There is an old man who lives here. And at this point, he comes to greet them. It turns out that he could really use their help because his daughter is ill and could stand to see a doctor. And the deal is that she's been given to fits of protracted slumber, and in fact, he's afraid that she's contracted the sleeping sickness. This was a big deal here in the 1920s. You can go check out our Sandman podcast, or if you want to hear more about that. But that is not actually what's going on here. It's also pretty clear to de Grandin, at least, that she's not this dude's daughter. But de Grandin plays along. He pretends to diagnose her and also to administer some medicine. And after this, their host, this old man, takes them to a room that the two of them can have for the night, and he leaves them alone. A little while later, they hear a scream from somewhere in the house. So as soon as the coast is clear, they rush back to this young woman's room, and they give her a stimulant to wake her up. And what they learn now is that their host has performed at least one bizarre surgery on her. And this he did in order to make her eyes weird. I'll just say weird, to make her eyes weird. And how she got here, how she got to this house, was very much the same way that our detectives have, except that in this case, her tires were shredded by some glass on the road, very clearly a deliberate trap. Now, this is not good, but then we can add to this the discovery that their host has gone out to their car and is at this very moment driving it into a lake so that there won't be any trace of their ever having come here. And it seems like there's going to be some kind of confrontation here at this point in the story, as they're actually watching the old man come back into the house from having sunk their car into a lake. But then, as he is doing that, he is struck by lightning and killed. So I guess everyone's going to be fine. And Brandon, I just have to say, this was a really bizarre move for me, right? As you're reading the story, you know that you are at the halfway point here. And I certainly was wondering, what then, if this old man is just now dead, what is the rest of the story going to be if they're already out of jeopardy?
Yeah, I mean, you do have to wonder at this point what's going to happen next. But I am so sold on everything that's been going on up to this point, you know, that I was just kind of excited to see what they were going to do. I mean, they have to figure things out. Like, we need some information as readers about what's going on. But I'm here for it, right? I've bought into the mad scientist living in a fun house, trapping young ladies and so on. But we don't know to what end or to what cause he's doing it. Or maybe he's not doing anything sinister. Maybe things are, as Trowbridge suspects, that this homeowner is just coming up on being an infirm old man and he needs mechanical contraptions to lock the doors in his house. And everything is perfectly innocent. You know, this is a perfect horror setup. De Grandin even swears by the devil's mustache. Is that a thing? I don't know. I mean, it's a great little line here. But Glenn, of course, you're right to point out these issues of pacing. Basically, Seabury Quinn has trapped his duo at the house with this car stunt, which was also used in Psycho to great effect, the hiding of cars in the ravine or a lake. And this opens up a new mystery that needs to be solved that will hopefully somehow get our heroes into a new car or something. I mean, there's lots of good going on here, but there's some logistical issues that we don't ever really get resolved.
I'm so glad, Brandon, that you are bringing the flavor of de Grandin into this, because I've left all of this out, all of his weird French exclamations. I've left all of that out of my recap notes here, but it is such an important part of this story. And this, as we talked about when we did Horror on the Links, this is Seabury Quinn dialing Hercule Poirot up to, I don't know, 13 or 14, I think. And it's absolutely delightful. It's really Poirot, maybe the way Kenneth Branagh played him in those mediocre films.
Yes, those mediocre green screen films, which I don't know, on a certain types of evenings are watchable. But yeah, I want to continue along this vein of critique here, because this story to me has so much promise, but it just doesn't deliver. And one of the issues that we're even coming up against now, halfway into the story, is that the seams of the plot are just too obvious. Like, why have our evil host killed in such an absurd way? Glenn, you mentioned this lightning strike, and the imagery is there for a lightning strike, but, and Trowbridge, for instance, calls the host's death the result of an arrow being shot from the bow of divine justice. But really, it's nothing so dramatic. It's just that wind breaks a limb off of an oak tree as the host is walking beneath it, and then he's crushed to death, basically. And then as he's laying there dying from internal bleeding, we suppose, he gets off a few like menacing words to de Grandon, who then says, well, I can't resist a riddle, so I need to go check up on everything that this guy said. And it's just, it's ham-fisted. I mean, Quinn's fists are just hams in this story. It's the most ham-fisted kind of storytelling I think I've ever come across.
Yeah, as we keep saying, we're going to have to take that up in the discussion here. But there is still a mystery to be solved, so we should go do that. I should say a mystery to be solved, even though there doesn't appear any longer to be an antagonist, right? But nonetheless, mystery. Though I do want to be clear, they don't really do very much detecting. They just have to explore the house. And so I think that we can tie this up pretty succinctly here and move into the discussion, which we are both so clearly very eager to go do. First, there are a lot of women in the secret dungeon that is underneath the basement. Many of them are dead. There are 14 skeletons down here, but there are also some people down here who are still alive, though alive is maybe not a great word for their condition, because they have been mutilated, they've been tortured. Many of them barely even physically resemble human beings anymore because of the just utterly horrifying surgeries that they've been subjected to. Second thing to say is that in their host's rooms, they easily figure out what is going on here, which is that their host is Dr. John Beersfield Marston, who was a famous surgeon who retired early after a tragedy befell his family. His son had committed suicide after the son's fiance called off their wedding at the last minute. The son was in a wheelchair, and that's a detail that seems to matter, but actually only by inference. I guess that's maybe also something we can take up in the discussion. But at any rate, the fiance was a famous vaudeville actress named Dora Lee. And so the deal is that Dr. Marston retired from his surgical practice so that he could spend his time mutilating young women who resembled Dora Lee. There doesn't seem to have been really ever at any point any rational plan here, but again, that is something we can take up in the discussion. And so at this point, really, the mystery is solved. Also, the storm is over, but there is still the matter of the women who are in this house, most of them, of course, down in the dungeon. De Grandon wants Trowbridge to consider whether or not they should maybe just put these mutilated women out of their misery, which is to say, kill them, or if they should go get the police. It becomes a moot point because it turns out that the serious business storm that's really the backdrop for all of this has caused some structural damage to the house, and the wall of the dungeon collapses and fills the dungeon up with bubbling ooze and therefore kills these imprisoned women. And so now they go upstairs and they get the mutilated woman in the bedroom. They take a walk to find a taxi, with de Grandon here at the end vowing that he will use all of his powers as a doctor in order to repair the damage that Marston has done to this woman. And that's the end of the story.
Well, I'm really excited to get into the discussion of this story, and we're going to get into it almost right away. I mean, I don't have too much to say about the end here. You summed it up beautifully, and everything I want to say is best suited for kind of the framing of the discussion that we're going to have. But before we get into that, we have some words about our patron content that we'd like to share with you.
Yeah, right. What we want to do here is let you know about planning for next year's two themes. Of course, this is one that we're doing this year, Occult Detectives, and then also our series on Borges. But we have, I mean, just a few days ago, wrapped up our first Patreon vote to select a broad category for next year, really two broad categories for next year. And I am really quite excited to let all of you know how that has shaken out. And in part, I'm so excited because it was extremely close. We had six categories on the ballot, and the top four of them were separated from each other by only one or two votes each. And so I really, really had to wait until the last possible day in order to tally up the votes and, you know, declare some winners here. And what came out on top was Breaking the Mold, which also we might call Now for Something Completely Different. And then what came in second was Stories in Translation.
Yeah, the other categories that we had on the ballot were reading stories that were going to take place in like the same type of setting. So I assume that would be something like Weird West or, you know, like Arkham, Massachusetts or something like that. And then stories that were rooted in a chronological time to kind of get a survey of a period of horror writing or weird writing. But yeah, those didn't obviously get as many votes as the ones that Glenn has already mentioned.
Right, though they almost did. There were two other categories on the ballot as well that were, well, quite near the bottom compared to these other four. So we'll see how story setting and chronological period do perhaps next year. But what really matters here is that now we are going to vote so that we can narrow this down a little bit. For stories in translation, we're going to go straight to voting on stories, or really on authors. But for Breaking the Mold, we're going to pick another medium first. And then we're going to pick specifically what we'll be reading. And the options here are two things that we've been talking about a lot, really, on the show anyway. That's pseudo-scholarship and role-playing games. But we'll also have on that ballot drama and poetry and comics. So in the end, next year, we're going to spend five or six, maybe, episodes of next year really getting away from what we normally do here, expanding our horizons a little bit. I'm very, very excited about that. And I'm also really, really curious to see what all of you are going to pick from this list here. And so if you would like to participate in having your say on what that is going to be, please come join us on Patreon at patreon.com/ClayTempleMedia.
You won't just be able to vote on these categories, which we are so excited about. I mean, this is a very exciting time for us at the network, but you'll have access to dozens. I don't know. What's a bigger number than dozens? Hundreds of bonus episodes and content and material, sneak peeks at what's coming up, new show launches, all sorts of stuff. So please, if you haven't, consider joining us on Patreon. At least go check out the page, see what we have to offer. We think you'll like it, and then join us after that. And then vote so we can know what to cover next year. We're so grateful for everybody who is already on Patreon. It's been wonderful. So thank you, and we look forward to more next year. But now we should return to the House of Horrors. The way I want to get into the discussion, I guess, is by reading a paragraph of the story, because I think, Glenn, you and I are going to have to do some work on this story. There's a lot of things that I love about this story, but there's a lot that needs work. And this paragraph, I think, is a pretty good way into that discussion, though. This is really something we'll just be keeping in mind as we move through our discussion. So this paragraph I'm about to read is one that kicks off the detecting portion of the story. I love it. It's full of problems. We're going to debate the merits of the paragraph towards the end of our discussion here today. But in any event, here it is, the section that begins after the wicked and resentful surgeon Dr. Marston dies. Here's what Trowbridge writes. We laid our gruesome burden on the hall couch and mounted the stairs to the second floor. With de Grandin in the lead, we found the dead man's room and began a systematic search for the papers he had mentioned, almost with his last breath. After some time, my companion unearthed a thick, leather-bound portfolio from the lower drawer of a beautiful old mahogany highboy and spread its wide leaves open on the white counterpaned bed. So again, I just want us to keep this paragraph in mind before or as we jump into the discussion. But before we do that again in earnest, I want to take a moment to dig into what I meant when I said that this story feels foundational to me in terms of what horror has become. In this story, we have, you know, the evil host, who is a classic Vincent Price type of character. You know, I've mentioned how the car hiding stuff shows up in Psycho. There's a lair under the house that contains really really just some evidence of a gruesome man's life and his life's pursuits. This trope shows up to great effect in the movie Barbarian, which was kind of widely lauded last year. And then there's really classic art horror movies like Eyes Without a Face and The Skin I Live In that are about surgeons trying to correct perceived mistakes or maleficent mistakes of the past by tormenting people with their surgical skills. There's a whole bunch of serial killer tropes here, trophy collecting, news clippings, and so on. Now, so much of what we think of as pure cliche today seems to have come out of this story. And I'm not sure if there's a real precedent for this story, but if there is, I don't think it would have anything quite so distilled as this story is in terms of the kind of the number of elements that go into making up this story. So I guess the first thing I really want to talk about before we dig into craft is that I want to know, Glenn, what sort of thoughts or references, if any, spun off in your mind while you read this story. Like, did you envision Vincent Price as the host, or like Hell House, or even Hill House for that matter? Like, where did your mind go while you were reading this story?
Well, 100% to Hill House, first of all, right? I think that is a nail that you have hit squarely on the head here, that this felt very much like it could be being narrated by Vincent Price. And I think on some level, I just was envisioning Vincent Price as Dr. Marston here, you know? So this is the Seabury Quinn story where Vincent Price gets struck by lightning, more or less, or crushed by a tree, you know, that's been struck by lightning, is kind of how this felt for me. So yeah, that's a huge image that came to mind. But also, just in terms of thinking about our own, you know, the genesis, I guess, of our own friendship, this really reminded me of the haunted house episodes, the Halloween haunted house episodes that we get from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It's that, you know, you walk into a house, the door closes behind you, and now the fun begins, and you have to explore in order to, you know, find your way out. But finding your way out is dependent on solving the mystery of the house, of uncovering the backstory. So those are just two, I don't know, those are probably really even the low-hanging fruit, really, of pop culture elements that have, you know, taken from this story, that have drawn so much from this story. Because I think that the list itself of films and TV episodes, and even also just other print stories that are taking their inspiration, I think, pretty directly from this story, is probably long enough to fill up an entire book of its own.
I'm just blown away by the fact that something even like Eyes Without a Face doesn't have any reference to Seabury Quinn, you know, and maybe they wouldn't. It's a French movie, and so maybe there's some animosity there towards Quinn's envisioning of a Frenchman. But it's unreal to me the number of tropey elements that it feels like this story invents. Now, reading it 100 years later, we're like, you know, this is everywhere. Like, this is very cliche, and there's some really cliche stuff here, even for the 1920s. But what people have taken from this story, like this has clearly gotten out into the popular imagination in a way that's almost indescribable. And I just really want to nail that point home. I guess that's what I want to open up with. And we've done that, but I can't emphasize it enough. Like, if you love horror, and especially the funhouse type of horror story, this is like the first one that I've read that feels like it could have been written today, though it needs a lot of work. And we'll be getting into that in just a little bit. Well, the next thing I want to kind of pause and examine here is the motivation for Marston's crimes. And I want to do this before we get into the craft stuff, because I think this is interesting and well handled in this story. Marston's crimes are really rooted in misogyny, right? I think Quinn captures something that is at the root of so much horror when he says in the story that basically the surgeon killed these women because he went from hating one woman to making an abstraction out of that woman and what she did to his son so that he could hate and punish all women. It's actually a really nice insight here. It's like why we all need to heal from breakups so we don't go to like making women's eyes weird, you know, when we go through that. But what I find really fascinating here is that Marston's son is the one who was really wounded by Dora Lee. But first, Marston's son was wounded when he was thrown from a horse during a polo match and he was paralyzed. So I want to be very clear here. I'm not comparing women to animals, but there's a question of why Marston Sr. went after women for pushing his son, you know, overboard into a sea of despondency and depression instead of like blaming the horse that threw him and really changed his life. You know, the question that lies at the root of what I'm getting at is this. What is it about the surgeon's attitudes toward women that make women both represent some kind of like salvific hope for him and his son? Well, at that same time, if the hope is dashed, make women responsible for everything wrong in his and his son's life. I mean, this is really a pervasive and pernicious attitude that's probably been around as long as people have been making abstractions of one another and then imputing those abstractions onto new people that they meet and so on. And I guess I rambled here for a bit, but what I'm getting at is this, is that this story is actually really rich with material that just goes unexplored. And there are times when you feel like, I guess you're reading more of an outline of a story than a fully formed tale. And this handling of misogyny is one of those things that could use, I think, a little more teasing out.
Yes, definitely. Because there's, I think, a really compelling backstory here that isn't really very well developed, though let's be clear, it's a short story, but this could have been handled differently in a way that made us feel, I think, a little bit more. Because what Quinn is doing here is really dialing up the horror of this and the discovery of that horror rather than inviting us, the readers, to think about this story from the perspective of Dr. Marston. And the inciting incident in his story is that his son died. His son took his own life. You and I are parents and primary caregivers to our kids, our very young kids. And for me, the idea of outliving my own child is the scariest thing that I can imagine. I literally have nightmares about it, right? And that's clearly what has happened to Marston here. This happened to him. His son died before him and killed himself, took his own life because of the intense feelings that he was having after having been left at the altar. And I find it very easy to sympathize with, to empathize with how Dr. Marston himself might be feeling in that moment. And of course, this is a fictional character, but this is something that has really happened to people, right? In the course of humanity's existence, this is something that has happened to millions of people, right? And there are some things that you can do with these feelings, some actions that you can take from these feelings that would actually be helpful to society, a productive way, a useful way or channel, I guess, within which to put these feelings, these emotions you're having. Like, think about equestrian safety and see if there's something positive that you could do there, you know, some letter writing campaign or something like that to get some safety measures implemented so that the accident that your son had doesn't happen to somebody else, something like that, right? There are things that he could be doing with his grief, with his trauma that would be positive, that would give him also then a feeling of agency and just activity here. But of course, instead, what he's done, right, is he's gone the negative route here, where what he wants, rather than to try to make the world a better place for other people, is what he wants is vengeance. And that's a cool story, right? This is a great story on that level, right? And thinking about how a person gets to this point of just performing bizarre surgeries on random women whose tires you have shredded by throwing glass on the road in front of your house in the middle of nowhere. That's a real terrifying story. But I wish that we had gotten more of this story from this perspective of walking us through the actual emotional arc of Dr. Marston from, even just to put things in 1920s horror terms, sanity to madness.
It's a real problem for this story. It really is. And it's a good, that the problem is that it's actually just a really good insight on Quinn's part that he just leaves hanging because he wants to describe boneless women flopping around in a madman's dungeon, right? And so like, This story either needed like 20 more pages or like five fewer pages. But there's a lot we can talk about here. Marston's plan or his vengeance campaign here is, it's actually insane, right? Like, he's throwing glass on the road. But what about the women that don't look like Dora Lee? Like, is he letting them go? What's going on? There's just so many big questions. And I think that at the heart of it, Quinn nails the motivation. He kind of nails the psychopathology here, but he leaves too much unexplored. And so maybe we can now move into the craft discussion here. And I want to really open the craft discussion, as I said, by considering the paragraph that I brought up at the top of our discussion portion of the conversation that we're having here today. I'm going to read it again here. We laid our gruesome burden on the hall couch and mounted the stairs to the second floor. With de Grandin in the lead, we found the dead man's room and began a systematic search for the papers he had mentioned, almost with his last breath. After some time, my companion unearthed a thick, leather-bound portfolio from the lower drawer of a beautiful old mahogany highboy and spread its wide leaves open on the white, counterpaned bed. What I want to do is dissect this paragraph as a way of examining some of these larger problems of the way that this story is told. Our two main characters have just witnessed the death of their adversary, really is an act of force majeure, which is kind of how all the problems are solved in this story. Then they pick up the muddy body, which is not narrated, nor is the like moving of the tree limb that crushed him off the body. They pick up this body, drop the gruesome burden off on the couch, and then in the next breath, in the same paragraph, Trowbridge is describing how beautiful some of the furniture of the house is, while the men are focused on, you know, the materials they're working with and the color of the pages. And really, they're doing this in service of investigating this dead man's final wish to be exposed for the mad genius he is. So they're kind of serving the wrong cause here. So there's really a lot of mixed motivations here. There's no really room for actually internalized thoughts. And then the real problem is this, that I actually like this paragraph a lot, but if I were editing this story, I'd have to tell Quinn to rewrite it. You know, tonally, there's just some problems. And so, Glenn, I wonder what you felt about the way this story was told and how you might go addressing and how you might go about addressing some of the tone issues of the tale or any other issues you feel this tale really had.
Right. I guess this is what I was getting at here, even in asking, begging Quinn to give us this story with a little more empathy, a little more sympathy for Dr. Marston's own tragedy, and to think about that character having an emotional arc. And it is that no characters in this story are having any kind of, not even just emotional arc, they're just not having emotions at all, that there is no interiority to any of this. It's all exteriority. And that's exactly what your paragraph shows, that it's, I want to describe this house and the contraptions in it and what this house looks like. And I'm all for that. I mean, I love descriptions of beautiful things. I prefer landscape to architecture, but I'm also into architecture as well. I mean, I'm on Team Lovecraft, you know, for both of these things, for sure. I love that about a story. But I also want to know what the characters are actually experiencing here, what it is like for them to be in the middle of this story, to be having an emotional reaction to the grim discoveries here, witnessing somebody get killed by a tree branch after it's been struck by lightning. And I'm also with you here, Brandon, in your critique of the complete absence of the scene where they have to actually remove this tree branch and then carry the body in. That labor is missing. And undergoing that labor just as a task is going to be a big part of anyone's actual narration of this, right? If this were something that happened to me and I'm telling you about it, you know, when we go out to the bar to do a little therapy for me, I'm going to tell you about the big heavy branch I had to lift off of a dead person and the dead person I had to carry inside. I'm also going to tell you how it was still storming. I'm totally wet because we actually had left our rain gear somewhere else in the house and didn't put it back on before we ran outside. Like, none of the actual experience of this story is happening to the characters. It's very bizarre.
It's so bizarre. I mean, not to mention the fact that we end the story on a freeze frame of a lighthearted chuckle and the desire for more whiskey. I mean, like that's a real issue of this story too. We have a story that opens with really casual feelings about the death of a child that they can't help, and ends with a oopsie daisy, I went the wrong direction in the rain, and that's how I didn't recognize the house. Like, that's not what we need resolution on. My question isn't, why didn't Trowbridge recognize the house they ended up at? My question is, how do they feel about the fact that them getting lost in the rain resulted potentially in a child's death, not to mention the fact that their inaction also resulted in the death of like 14 boneless women. You know, like it's insane. Quinn, that's what I mean when I say that this story feels like an outline instead of a real story. And as much as I love all of the concepts and the horror ideas that Quinn has put in this funhouse, it does feel like walking through a carnival attraction more than it feels like reading a story.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I definitely read this story with this the specter, I guess, of this little girl with diphtheria hanging over my head. I assume that's going to get resolved, that's the thing that they're going to go do once they get out of the house. And I understand that there's this mystery that they have to solve. They get this clue right from Marston as he's dying that suggests that there are more people in the house. And so, okay, we're going to help the people who are, you know, right here immediately, but we still are trying to get to this little kid who needs our help. And that's just completely forgotten by the end of the story. And that leaves me feeling bad about the whole experience of having read this story. And then there are other places, as we've said along the way, where I also feel that way. But I also think it's just not very good narrative technique that, in fact, embedded in this story are there are several elements that, in fact, heighten some tension, give us some suspense. And the trying to get to this little kid, that's a ticking countdown clock that Quinn could have been using as a narrator, by reminding us that this is actually still the thing that they're trying to do. That's what they're out here for to begin with. I mean, give us just a literal clock rather than have our characters shrug their shoulders in the beginning of the story and say, well, it's that adventure's over because it's just already probably too late. Just give us something like, well, we could, we still have 4 hours. You know, if we can get there within 4 hours, then we can help her. Now I've got real stakes in this story then, right? And then complicate that by the discovery that, well, there are other people here who need our help. And so now we're making a choice about that. How can we help everybody that we're meant to help? I mean, right? Give us some stakes there. And the elements for that are present in the story. So it really is the execution of it that is lacking.
It's why I have such a hard time with this line, after some time, my companion unearthed the leather-bound portfolio and so on. It's like the time is a kind of the essence. Like you have things to discover. Sure, you have to do the investigation first, whatever. You have to go. But why are you listening to this old man's? Why are you honoring his wishes anyway? You've witnessed the mutilation that he's done to one woman. Why are you doing anything in service to the school, right? It's like, there's just so many. Actually, we'd have to spend the next hour kind of teasing out the things that need to be changed, when in fact, it would be Quinn's job as the writer. You know, if I were the editor, I would just send this story back and just say, rewrite it with some thought and care. And that would be my whole note for the story, because there's too many things that need to be fixed to have this story live up to the promise of its premise. And that's really, I think that's what's so disappointing about this story, even though if you're a horror fan, you need to read this story.
Something I want to be clear about here, I mean, we said this earlier, we're both on Team Seabury Quinn here. We have really enjoyed Seabury Quinn, even elements of this story. And my, I guess, crit fic about this story is that, yeah, it's the sixth of these stories. He wrote one and didn't know that there were going to be more. Then he wrote a second one, which you and I are going to cover soon. So I won't say anything specific about that for people who are wanting to read along. But that's very clearly a sequel to the first story rather than another installment in a series. And I think that at this point, the demand for these stories, they're all published in Weird Tales. I think the demand from the editor of Weird Tales for these stories has outpaced what Seabury Quinn was able to keep up with, because Seabury Quinn, this is his night job, right? This is his evenings and weekends hobby. He's got a serious business day job as an attorney. And I think he just had to get this, you know, a draft, basically. This is a story outline that he sent in, but because there was so much demand for these stories, the editor of Weird Tales, I'm not sure who it was actually at this point, published the story anyway. And that's fine, because look, there's like 100 other of these stories. You know, I think my sense is that most of them are really great. Some of them are going to be clunkers like this. I mean, it's just like watching, you know, Star Trek or X-Files. That's the way serialized story entertainment is. So I know we're beating up on Quinn pretty hard here, but I don't think that the problem is Quinn. The problem is, you know, the system, the way that stories are told. And that system, the way that stories are told here in the 1920s, the 1930s, this pulp era, yields some amazing material, but sometimes it causes problems like this too.
Yeah, and it's kind of really a mixed bag. Like I've said, I really love this story, but it's an outline. It's not a story. It needs a whole new draft. It needs massive revisions. But that's okay. I mean, that's like, as you pointed out, that is the time period. That is a result of the conditions under which this story was written and published. And I love it. I mean, if you are out there and you're like, man, I would love to make a throwback to Hammer Horror or Vincent Price movies, and you want to commission a screenwriting treatment of the story, I want to write a screenplay for this story. I think this would be good practice for a screenplay, because the outline is there and the work is done. Basically, it's just going to take some tweaking. Let me know. I won't have time to do it, but it's nice to dream. See if you want to play along. Yeah. Well, if we're thinking about writing screenplays here, we should probably call it a day. So that is going to do it for this episode. Once again, I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. As always, you can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. We hope you'll check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/claytemplemedia so that you can vote on next year's themes and also get access to, I guess what I would say, Brandon, is scores of bonus episodes that we
have.
There
you go. That's the word.
We are rapidly approaching hundreds. We're close to having 200 bonus episodes up there. But scores, yeah, that's the word for right now.
We also want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, John R. Foltz. We have been loving reading through the tales in his book, Darker Than Weird, and we hope you will check it out, buy a copy, and, just thanking John also for sponsoring these episodes, and we think you'll enjoy it. So thanks again to John, and until next time, we greet you and say farewell.